Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, this is understanding that when people live a monastic life, they don't just come into the monastic life pure, without blemishes, and are perfectly enlightened. They always have their wishes and their desires. It's part of life. But this is a very skillful teaching by... And it's interesting to see this the way the Buddha actually teaches here, that understanding people's defilements, their cravings, their desires, using those cravings and saying, if you really want all these things, this is what you have to do. And of course, what you have to do eventually is to enlightenment anyway. So I'm going to pad this out. There's a very famous story of the Buddha's cousin, Nanda. And if you don't know that story, I'm going to tell it to you, and it's a good advice why you should never invite a monk to give a blessing at a wedding. Because the story is this, that Nanda was the Buddha's cousin. And so when he was getting married, of course, he invited his cousin the Buddha and a few monks to come to the wedding feast, just to give them some alms round and get a blessing for good luck before he did his marriage. So the Buddha went with his monks, gave a quick blessing and received some alms food. But then he told Nanda, his cousin, you know, you're my cousin, you have to take the bowl back to the monastery for me. In very much the same way that people wait for the door after our alms round, you take my bowl upstairs. And so Nanda just was put in the spot because the Buddha was an elder and he had to basically follow the orders. So he told his bride-to-be, his fiancée, he said, look, I'll only be a few minutes, just take the bowl back to the monastery and then I'll be back. And according to the story I read, that was where his bride-to-be spat on the floor, she's a pretty sort of rough lady, and said, you better be back before this dries up. Which I thought was an interesting part of the story.
I like that.
So if any of you sort of, you know, want to say, I'm just going, Kapel is doing the dishes, and he said, oh, Ajahn Brahm must be to take to Jhana Grove. You can spit on the floor and say, Kapel, you better be back before this dries up for us. But of course, what happened, as soon as the Buddha got Ananda to the monastery, you know, he used his powers and ordained Ananda, made him a monk. Now, usually it's against his wishes, but he obviously must have used something to get him to be a monk. But that's the story, so he became a monk. So his wife-to-be was very fed up. But, you know, he said, look, only just a couple of days and I'll be out of here. You know, he says, no, just my cousin, he's a Buddha, so, you know, just, you know, give him a week and then I'll just arrive and come back to you. Sorry about this, but, you know, that's what happens if you've got a relation as a Buddha. But what the Buddha did, according to this, is pretty sexist, so please excuse me, but this is what he did. He used his psychic powers and took Nanda up to one of the heaven of the 33, the Tower Tingsaril. And you know, he said, look at all these beautiful heavenly girls. Now, which is nicer, these heavenly nymphs, you know, or your loved one down in the earth? And he looked at them, and he was just pretty sort of, he couldn't have been that intelligent or that sort of, but he said, actually, you know, the ones up here, you know, are far more hot than my sort of girlfriend down there. And the Buddha said, well, look, if you carry on as a monk, then, you know, after a while, this is where you get reborn. So, you know, it's worth the sacrifice. And he said, okay, fine. So that was it, the marriage was off. And it's a true story, read it. This is how it's written. And in the meantime, now all the other monks, they actually criticise. You know what it's like in the monastery, and they criticise each other sometimes, even though you're not supposed to. He said, "Now that's a monk. He's only becoming a monk to get some nice hot girls after he dies. That's the only reason he's becoming a monk. Not a real monk. You know, it's just a weird way of having his lust." But in the meantime, he actually started practicing, had nothing else to do, kept his precepts, and then started meditating, and soon he became fully enlightened. He became an arahat. And so the Buddha was very smart there, how he, tricked his cousin to say, if you practice, keep the Eightfold Path, your next life you'll have as many sort of nice girls as you like. But if you practice the Eightfold Path, he became, obviously so good, he became a light and he wasn't interested in any sort of sensory things anymore, became an arahat. And so you can see the Buddha's skillful means sometimes. So even here, this is very similar. He says, well, if you want these things, just keep the precepts, just have solitude, and then you get sort of whatever you want. But what he's really saying is, if you do this, you'd also get full enlightenment as well. So it's a skillful means. So it gives you an idea of sort of what was going on in the time of the Buddha and how you do use skillful means to sort of, sometimes trick people. I call it brainwashing, but it's all for a good cause. Please excuse me. It's called skillful means, upaya. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove on Artapindika's Park. You may notice that most of the suttas come from there, because that's the last 25 years of the Buddha's life he was staying in that place. There he addressed the monks thus. Monks, when also they replied, the Blessed One said this: monks, dwell possessed of virtue, possessed of the Patimokkha, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, which is our precepts, the 227 precepts for the monks and the 311 ones for bhikkhunis. Perfect in conduct and resort. So conduct is your general conduct, and the resort is a special word. It actually literally means gochara, and gochara means where cows wander. So it means that you don't wander into pubs or into places of ill repute, because you don't know what people might think. There was a story, because I always, this is a very simple sutta, but I make some stories to pad it out. There was one of the fellow monks, he was an Australian, I know his name, his lay name, Jasper his name was, and his parents visited him in Thailand. So he came down to Bangkok, stayed in the temple, his parents stayed in a hotel, and he took his parents around. And one day he was taking his parents around Bangkok, and it was getting time, they were getting some lunch, he was looking for a place to have lunch. And he was an Australian, his parents were actually from Denmark, but they migrated to Australia a long time ago, and he didn't really understand Thai that well. And so he's walking around trying to find a restaurant, and he saw a shop with a chicken sign on the outside. So he assumed that was a restaurant, so he went inside and sat down. And there was no sort of smell of food, and no actually waiters came up to see him. But whoever was the waiter there were very well dressed women, but they just kept looking at him very, very strangely, and no one came up to ask him what he was doing. And it was only much later, that they walked out, they realized that it was in the Chinese quarter, and in Chinese tradition the chicken is the symbol for the brothel. So he'd taken his, as a monk, he'd taken his parents into one of the houses of ill repute in the centre of Bangkok. And he didn't realise what it was at first. But anyway, so that's called wrong resort. So that's what it says over here. So that's the place where you're not supposed to. And it was totally innocent. He just didn't know what he was doing. But of course, it can be embarrassing, and sometimes people can add two and two and add and make five, and they just get the wrong idea. So that's why we should, as monks, never go to such places. There was one year over here that someone had dogged me in for some award, and they were having the award ceremony in the ballroom of Burswood. Now, Burswood is a hotel, but it also has a casino there. And so I had to go to the awards ceremony, and I went with our president at that time, Sol Hanna. And these are Buddhists, we'd never been to Burswood before. That's where the casino is. And so he didn't know where the ballroom was. I didn't know where it was. So he parked wherever he could. And we went in and was walking around looking for the ballroom. And of course, I was walking not knowing where I was going. And then I suddenly turned around And there was a casino right in front of me. And it was just as if the monk was about to go into the casino. And so I had to sort of tell Sol, quick, let's get out of here. So we walked very quickly. Because if someone had been there, quick, here's Ajahn Brahm going to the casino. And of course, you wouldn't, it's very hard to actually to you know, say, well, I was lost, you know, in this big complex. I was just trying to find the ballroom for a ceremony. Because that's why that we have this resort, you know, not putting yourself in situations where people can misunderstand what you're doing. So, we were straight and perfect in contact and resort, and seeing fear in the slightest thought. Now, this is an interesting thing. The word like fear is not the same as the way we have fear in English. It's just seeing the consequences, you know, of the wrong actions. It's not just being sort of tense and being so anxious. It's not an anxious fear, but it's just the logical fear. In the same way, you'll see fear in like a small fire in the hot weather in Australia. It can make a bushfire. You know, you see fear sort of, you know, crossing the road. Now, you're not anxious, but you're careful. So that's what it really means, and the slightest faults. So they're dangerous. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it's not that one doesn't always break some rules. And the simile which I give, if you haven't heard it before, there was one disciple many years ago, and his name was Donald Clark. I don't mind saying his name, he died a long time ago now. And he was this old English Buddhist, and you know, he was in the British Navy, and then when he retired to Perth on his pension, and he was a good Buddhist. But one day, you know, he had a heart attack, so he went to the hospital, and I went to see him straight away. And, you know, he just had a blockage in his arteries, easy to fix up. And in those days, they will give you bypass surgery. So he was on the emergency list for a bypass. So I went to see him a couple of times, you know, before his operation. And one evening, his wife called me. And she was very, very concerned. I thought, is Don all right? He said, no, he's all right. It's me who's the problem. So what's happened? He said, because I've been married to him for about 37 years now, and this evening or this afternoon I lied to him for the first time. And I feel so bad. So what happened? And she said, well, you know, in his ward there were three other beds, and all of them were waiting for the bypass operation. And one, the person in the next bed, you know, they became friends, as you do when you're in hospital ward, you know, with no one else to talk to. The person in the next bed had the bypass operation this morning. And unfortunately he died, complications. When my husband asked, how did Jack do in his bypass? I lied. I said he was okay and in ICU, recovering. I lied to my husband because I was afraid that, you know, if I told him that the man in the next bed died under the operation which, you know, my husband's having tomorrow, you know, that could make him so afraid that, you know, that might sort of kill him too. You know, she was obviously very right, because he was on the edge of life and death. You know, he pulled through, he survived, but it was touch and go for quite a while. And so I told her afterwards, I said, no, you've done no wrong. Yes, you've broken precepts, you've lied. But it's a good thing you did. When I tell that story, I tell it's all right as a Buddhist to lie. But no more than once every 37 years. So it's seeing fear in the slightest faults, so it's very dangerous. I call the faults, it's like coming to the traffic lights, and it's a red traffic light. Should you go through that red traffic light? And if you're taking Matt's just had a heart attack and you're driving him to the hospital, of course you go through that red traffic light if it's safe, because it's an emergency. So this is what we mean by seeing fear in the slightest faults. It means it's a danger, it's a red light, so be very, very careful. 37 years, you probably won't ever go through that. But it doesn't mean you're so anxious and so afraid if it's time to go through, because extenuating circumstances, you go through. But obviously, if it's a red light, you make sure there's no traffic so you can safely go through. Yeah, that's all.
So is the danger that it creates like an outflowing of the mind to start wandering and kind of a disturbance from the present.
I think the fear, the same fear here, the anxiety, oh, I can't sort of break any rule. Oh, I must keep all the rules. Oh, I must be perfect. The anxiety is the biggest problem. So with all rules and regulations, they're there for a purpose. Understand what the purpose is. And 99% of the times, once every 36 years, 364 days, you keep all the precepts. But there's always that one or two times in your life, you see something, and because you are mature, you understand what those precepts are there for. You think, okay, it's a proper thing to do. But it's very rare. So this is not a blank check to break all your precepts and rules.
So it's only like kindness and compassion and God.
And indeed it is. Because the law of karma is that any intentional act is karma. But its quality, whether it's wholesome karma, skillful karma, unskillful karma, depends on the motivation, whether it's coming from compassion, coming from renunciation, kindness, gentleness, or whether it's coming from wanting something, personal gain, whether it's ill will, whether it's violence.
That sort of means a maturity to look behind the surface of the world.
That's right. So that's why the fear is there. In a sense, this is dangerous. It's like maybe a bushfire. So you're not anxious. If you're anxious, you overreact, or you're frozen, you don't act at all. But it's seeing danger there. That's actually why usually the translation which I prefer, which is actually more common than seeing fear in the slightest fault, is seeing danger in the slightest fault. So danger is a much better word, because fear has all these amazing psychological connotations in the West.
So, Jane, is it in a sense like reflecting how does one's action harmonise with the Eightfold Path?
Eightfold Path with defilements, what's its consequence going to be? If it's going to kill someone, it's the right thing to do. So, if it's going to be breaking a precept, be careful. Red light, is it safe? Does it really need to be done? If you really consider yes, you have to go for it. Yes, Richard?
Is it the same word as the fear and fear and dread
sutra? That's a good point. I'll just check it for you, because I've got the Pali here. Oh, I should know, because we chant this every week. It's... where is it? Oh, no, I forget it. Oh, come on. Here we go. Baya, yes, it is actually the same as Baya. So the previous one was fear and dread. That was a long time ago, fear and dread one. Baya, bear away, yeah. So it's like danger. Seeing danger. But bearer, well, they need that fear and dread, that danger, and the bearer was real sort of anxiety. So you might even call that, instead of fear and dread, danger and anxiety. That might be a good translation of that fear and dread sutta. So, to just go over number two again. Dwell possessed of your virtue, possessed of the Patimokkha precepts, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, perfect in conduct and result, seeing danger in the slightest fault, trained by undertaking the training precepts. So that was his bit of advice. He's obviously for young monks. If a monk should wish, may I be dear and agreeable to my companions in the holy life, respected and esteemed by them. In other words, may people like you. And of course, that's part of being a human being, want to be liked and be respected by one another. And so if you want to be respected and have lots of friends, then fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight and dwell in empty places. Now this is actually very good advice, because people think, if I'm going to be dear and agreeable to my companions in the holy life, I have to hang out with them. I have to sort of be friends with them, chat with them, invite them around for a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. But That doesn't make you dear and agreeable to your companions in the holy life. It doesn't make you respected. So you have to keep your precepts. And then you do get respected. There was a monk over in Malaysia, and Venerable Agachitta, if any of you know him. But he started a monastery. He wanted to train monks in Malaysia, so they didn't have to keep getting these imports from Australia like myself. So they could have their own homegrown ones. So being like a modern, Western educated monk, he decided, what type of monk do I want to produce? Finding out what the product's going to be. So to find out, he decided to do a survey. So he had this survey, which I saw, given to as many Buddhists as he possibly could find in Malaysia. To tick, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What the qualities you want most out of a monk or a nun? Is it they have to be like charismatic, be a good speaker, being able to teach the kids in Dharma school, be a great meditator, be able to write books, keeping their precepts, being able to manage temples, to be able to build, to be a counsellor which people can come to? Now, what type of monk do you want? And when they did the survey, and people had to tick, put in order 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and he collated them all, the clear winner was keep precepts. Yeah, and that was such a beautiful thing which he did, because some of the monks thought, if I keep my precepts, it's so difficult to teach. If I keep my precepts and keep all those precepts, I won't be able to teach all the kids. I won't be able to manage the temple. And it was a wake-up call for the monks, because this was coming from the lay people. They'd actually ask, what do you want from a monk? And they said, the first thing we want is one who keeps their precepts. Someone we can be proud of and respect. Even more than being a great teacher. So if that's all you do, you keep your precepts, we're happy that you're there. The other things are bonuses. And that was a brilliant sort of piece of research, which is why I often quote it. So if you want to be dear and agreeable to your companions in the holy life, monks, nuns, lay people, respected and esteemed by them, fulfill your precepts. And don't follow the sort of the false idea, breaking the precepts makes it you easier to be looked after and more agreeable to the lay community. It doesn't work that way. That's what monks think. Lay people think the opposite. They want you to keep their precepts. And, of course, this is what I really like, be devoted to internal serenity of mind. So, it's not just outer serenity, but the inner serenity. And I like that internal. Because a lot of time it's easier to make the outside calm and quiet. You can just sit here. Now, if it's outside, you look very peaceful, but inside you're in turmoil, holding your mind so tight. That's not the internal serenity of mind, it's the external. If you want to see a good example of external serenity, go to Buckingham Palace and see those soldiers who are sitting in those boxes for hours. And people take photos of them, they poke them or whatever they do, try to upset them, and they're perfectly still. But that's not internal serenity of mind, that's external serenity. So be devoted to internal serenity of mind. Don't neglect the meditation. It's the Buddha's advice. This is if you want to be respected and esteemed by your friends. They want to have people, if you're a monk, a nun, a samanera, a novice, an anagarika, a lay Buddhist, to get respect, to be a meditator. Even more so than being a teacher. Be possessed of insight. So you know that you do. Not knowledge. Not just being a professor of Buddhism or Abhidharma, because everyone can get that from the books. To be esteemed and respected, they want you to have the insight, which means that you can answer questions very quickly, not just from the books, but just from your deep understanding. And of course, being with someone like Ajahn Chah, who had very little education and didn't read the Abhidharma or many suttas, but he had such great insight. Which is why that sometimes you ask the question, it was bang, right to the heart of it. Which was that brilliant, being able to live with a monk like that, who certainly was possessed of insight, could see right through things very quickly. And that's and also not empty huts. I've mentioned this before. Dwell in secluded abodes. That's the empty huts means secluded abodes. So like this place is a secluded abode. So he said, don't just stay in town where you can serve lots of people with plenty of people around you. See if you can dwell in seclusion. Well, as it goes, this is quite secluded by most people's standards. It's sometimes, you know, that it's an important point, that just maybe it is not quite what you meant, but it's associated with it. Sometimes the monks here, the novices, and you know, Anipema and the Anagarikas of India, sometimes you think, oh, this is just too luxurious. You know, just look at the, we don't have a lunch, we have a feast every day. It's a banquet. And the rooms are very comfortable for you. But even so, sometimes that you forget what it's like out there in the real world. In the real world, you know, you have far more choice of what you eat. And sometimes there's things in there you don't like and you would like. Yeah, there's more choice. But remember, if you were living back in your home, you'd have the choice of the whole supermarket. The choice of being able to ring up, take away, do whatever you like. So the food which you would eat would always be a bit more preferable than what you have here. And you'd have all the other sort of luxuries which you know you were normally used to. If you live here long enough, sometimes you think this is luxurious. But if you go home for a few days, you know, you realize this isn't really luxurious. And some few years ago, we had a group of scholars. They were religious scholars, you know, from Queensland. No, it was actually a conference, and there was some from Queensland came along here. And they visited the Benedictine monastery in New Norcia, first of all. And they took them around there. And then they came to our place, and they had a look around our place. And I caught two of them talking together and said, if ever I become a monk, Benedictine, this place is too coarse and too rough. At least you can have wine. And over the Benedictine monastery, you can watch TV and you can do other things over there. And they have three meals a day. So I remember telling the monks that story because that made them feel good, because they thought this place was too indulgent. They realised, you know, sometimes because you're here, you've got nothing to compare it with. So this actually is not that. So it's actually reasonably secluded and reasonably, believe it or not, austere. I'll take you to some other monasteries. I've visited some other monasteries over in Thailand or other places. I don't know what it's like in Korea. So some of the monasteries in some monasteries in Korea, do they have TVs?
Oh,
there we go.
Three meals.
Yeah. Okay. So this is actually quite austere. Money as well. Yeah. Come on. Okay. Yeah.
Is this sutta directed towards monastics who live in a monastery, or is it just directed towards monastics? Because it doesn't specify here, but I would think, because the last one is the dwelling in seclusion,
yeah.
I think it's more for those who are practicing themselves.
I remember in those days that sort of it was expected that all monks and all nuns would be practicing, and also the upasaka, upasikas. Mm-hmm. The lay men and the lay women, so devotees, they too would be seeking seclusion. So this would be mostly addressed, this looks to me it's like addressed to the young monks just ordaining, but it would also be spread around to the bhikkhunis and also to the lay men and lay women.
So was the people who were in a monastery or people who were
going off? Probably still in a monastery at first, yeah. Because I believe in the monastery there was seclusion, but even more so, obviously, that for those who are going to go off and find seclusion allowed.
Because the last
advice is to cultivate the empty places. That's right, yes. So even for lay people,
and
too.
And that's the most important one in this list, most likely.
It's quite likely, because it's at the end. But don't neglect meditation, be possessed of insight, dwell in seclusion. And it's great, because this, for companions in the holy life, for people who are really into the holy life, this is what makes you agreeable and dear to them. So it's using that tendency or that sort of a part of being a human being is wanting to be liked, wanting to be accepted, wanting to be part of a group, wanting to be dear to your fellows. You know, we all want that. He said, this understanding that this is what you have to do. So just the same way as, you know, if you want to have, you know, nice women in the next life, you know, this is what you have to do, like Tananda. Similar there. It's, you know, using people's defilements, wanting to be accepted by others, using that and say, this is what you have to do to get them into a much deeper path. Yeah. Yeah, it's very good. I think it's the old. I think it's the jhana one. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the jhana one, but I will check it out. It is. Yes? Anirakata jhana. So, nirakata is actually just to look after. No, there's no Thai people here. The Thai word is raksa. It means look after, careful. So, don't. Not look after your jhanas, your meditation. So don't neglect jhanas. Be possessed of insight, that's vipassana, and dwell in empty huts, which is the sunya gauri. Let's make sure that's. Okay, yeah, sunya gauri. It doesn't mean empty huts, it means just empty places, it means seclusion. And not just actually physical seclusion, the mental seclusion as well. The empty abidings in your mind as well. So a mind which has nothing in it, spacious. No past, no future, no thoughts. Okay, now that's just, you know, so you get on with one another, so you have good friends. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I be one to obtain robes, arms, food, resting place and medicinal requisites. These are the four requisites. And again, some young monks, they always like the best requisites. Did I tell here the story of the big mugs for coffee and whatnot? I think that was actually one of the Wednesday night talks. Sorry?
The mugs,
yeah, the Tupperware mugs. That's it's really funny. It's the first year as a monk, because there would be, if you are lucky, a big kettle, maybe with coffee or Milo, something sweet, which is very, very rare. And one of the monks would come down and fill your cup. You only have one cup, and that was it. You don't make it yourself. It was just communal. And of course, you had a small cup, you just got a small drink. The bigger the cup, the more you had to drink. And so, we all had the cups which we were given. But some monks would write letters to their family back in the United States or wherever they were. Please send me a bigger mug. And he got bigger and bigger and bigger over the months. And so one of these mugs, he had this enormous, it was more like a bucket than a mug. And that meant he could get more coffee. And it was so extreme that that was the end of it. So we all got the same size from that time on. But you can see this is just like, you know, we've only got a few possessions, we want the best. You know, we want nice shoes, or we want sort of, I don't know what else we have, a nice flashlight. So over here we say not sort of the resting place medicinal requisites. May I obtain, you know, the best flashlight, you know, the best iPod, if you've got iPods on the talks, whatever. So this is just knowing, just desires, even in a monastery, will still sort of come up. You know, and it may not be for the same sort of things you have in the world, but, you know, whatever we have here. So, okay, you know, that's, you know, part of being a human being if you're not enlightened yet. So if you really want to have the best flashlight, or the best iPod, or what else do you have? The best reading glasses? I don't know. There's not much we have here. Then, what should you do? Let him fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight and dwell in seclusion. Look at all the things which people give me. So it works, you know. You get a, you know, nice, what's the latest thing I've got? I've got these noise equalizing headphones. So if you go on the aircraft, you can meditate, it's nice and quiet. So if any of you want the best noise equalizing microphones, what should you do? Fulfill your precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, possessed of insight and dwell in seclusion. It worked for me, so it must work for you too. Yes. That's right, because in that, when the Buddha was saying, that was, if you want these things for your next life, so if you want to be rich in your next life, be generous in this one.
But if you want stuff now, then you have to practice your...
in this life.
Okay.
Not just now. I want it now. I just remember that story. I think I was staying in somebody's... It was a house in Manhattan when I was visiting New York. That's actually when I saw you.
Yeah.
And he had his TV on, and there was... I saw a little clip from the Addams Family. Had,
the
Walton? Yeah, it was a bit of a movie. And it was... Actually, I remember because I used to see it as a kid on the TV show.
Yeah.
And they had the kid Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Pass me the salt." And her mother said, "What's the magic word?" And she said, "Pass me the salt now." It's really funny. Okay, well done. You've got to imagine what's supposed to be, please. No, that's being polite, but not the Addams Family, totally opposite. Pass me the salt now. That reminded me of when you said now. So anyway, if a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni or upasaka should wish, now this is more, you know, a bit higher. May the services of those whose robes, arms, food, resting place, and medicinal requisites I use bring them great fruit and benefit. Now this is actually a good one for each one of us here. All these people are feeding us. You know, the white clothes you've got, many of them come from the stores. You know, the huts which you live in, myself or Bhamari or these other monks, we worked hard to build these. Even this hall here you're sitting in here, my name's on the building license for that one. So amazing just how much, you know, people have actually looked after you so that you can sit in a monastery, so you can stay in jhana grove, and you know, people still look after you. So you think, my goodness, they're looking after me. And it's not just the monks, each one of you. So in order for their sacrifice, their generosity to be the highest fruits, so you're looking after the people who have supported us, then you should keep your precepts. Devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, but possessive insight and dwell in seclusion. And all the people who come and bring food every day will be so happy. So if you want them, their gifts and sacrifice to bear fruit, each one of us should try our very best to be good meditators, keep our precepts. Because imagine what would happen is, you know, people, like, you know, Lincoln, you just come here. If you came here and you realised that, you know, we're messing around, just, you know, having secret TVs in our hut, having parties and messing around, playing cards in the evening. And then you think, just all that stuff which you've given to the monastery, you think, just what do I do this for? And you get so upset and just dispirited that all that sort of stuff you gave was sort of no use at all. But if you come in, you find actually people actually meditate here, you know, there is a sort of a good place, people do keep their precepts. That means all of the donations you've given, all the food which you've offered, you think, wow, it was really worth it. And it makes your gift give you much more happiness. So that's what they're saying here. If you want the services of those whose well done with resting place and medicinal requisites which you use, if you want to give great fruit and benefit to those donors, fulfill your precepts, devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect jhanas, be possessed of insight and dwell in seclusion, you make them very happy. But don't go into a guilt trip, you know, if you didn't meditate today and think, gee, I don't deserve the food, maybe I should fast tomorrow. That doesn't make the people happy. That means you're just in some weird guilt trip. And if bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, monk, layman, laywoman, when my kinsmen, my relations, who have passed away and died, remember me with confidence in their mind, may that bring them great fruit and great benefit. So this is actually one of the things I just advised someone the last couple of nights who was dying over in Singapore. You know, to think of like Sangha members, you know, especially who you really respect and inspired by. And if you think of them, then when you die it brings you lots of joy and happiness. As long as those Sangha members have actually kept their precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect their meditation, possessed of insight and dwell in seclusion. It inspires people. And so that inspiration, you know, people who have actually done some work and actually lived the holy life, at least, you know, almost there or wholly there, people who die remember that. That gives them a huge boost. So they're saying here, this is one of the things, when my relations, when they pass away, if they remember me with confidence in their mind, that will bring them great fruit and benefit. Only if you really actually lived a good life. So that's for others, because this is your compassion. The compassion for the people who serve you, and the compassion for your friends and relations. You want to do something for them. So how can you help and serve your relations? How you can do that is by keeping your precepts, devoting internal serenity of mind, not neglect your meditation, but possessed of insight, and dwell in seclusion. That inspires. So I mean, it's taken me, 37 years to inspire my brother. And at last he's come here and he's seen, and I think he's inspired now. Before he didn't know what I was up to. So, and I could only do that because I've been doing all these things. If a monk, now we come to the internal things, that you, this is for compassion for others, now about your own problems. If a bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, upasaka should wish, might I become a conqueror of discontent and delight? May discontent not conquer me. May I abide, transcending discontent whenever it arises. Let him fulfill the precepts. This is arati and rati. So especially discontent. Just how much does that cause problems in your life? Never being happy wherever you go. You get beautiful food and you can't be content because it's too good. You have a beautiful room and you can't be content because it's too comfortable. Oh, you know, you're just the bone room around the back with all the ghosts and say, oh, why can't I get a hut like everybody else? And that, you know, that's discontent. So it's just so easy. You can be discontent anywhere. As I tell you with that simile of the prison and the monastery, discontent has got nothing to do with your circumstances, but very much with your attitude. Do you want to be here, or do you want something more? So if you want to conquer that, and the delight, you know, is the opposite of discontent, when you just really want, and just overly indulging in things. If you want to overcome those things, then keep your precepts. Devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight, dwell in seclusion. And you'll find those things vanish. It's interesting, the dwelling in seclusion, which we're saying in the end there, just dwelling in seclusion, being by yourself, you'll find that maybe you might not get great insight or get jhanas, but a lot of discontent disappears. As many of you probably find over this retreat, spending time alone is a huge boost, you know, to contentment. So it works even if you're not a good meditator, if you think you're stupid, just spending time alone really helps. Yeah.
The sort of qualitative difference between the delight, or discontent, delight, and dukkha, sukha.
Okay, yeah. It's even if you have dukkha, you know, you can just be at peace with dukkha. It's part of life. So, you know, the dukkha which I experience must be, you know, result of past karma. So I'm content.
know, to have the stomach ache. I'm content to be tired. I'm content, you know, not to be as agile as I used to be. I'm content to have a sore eye because I just had a cataract operation. You know, yes, it's irritating, but you know, you've got to take it. So you're content with it. Discontent is just, when's it going to get better? I want it to get better. Can't they give me something to make it better? That's sort of the discontent part.
So it's the second arrow.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, exactly. So the two arrows is the physical arrow and the mental arrow. Physical arrow you can't do much about. Yeah, it gets cold, it's hot. You know, you have pain, you have sort of ease in the body. So that's the physical arrow of dukkha. And the mental arrow is the one you can do something about. I don't want. Why is this happening to me? It's not fair. Okay, so that's the... Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
The word delight, because it's mentioned a lot in other sutras, like whatever we delight in, we're praying our home, future samsara and all that. Could you elaborate more on the word delight?
It's kind of vague. It is very vague. And sometimes you see at the end of the sutra here, it's... This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So they didn't conquer the delight. That's why actually it's the discontent which is the one which is most important here. And the delight is just, you know, just this opposite. It's, you know, if you delight in some things, you'll be discontented in other things. Just like night and day. So it's only discontent if, you know, when you do get what you want, you delight in it. Ooh, today I got what I wanted. Ooh, today. Or, yes, today we got half a hot dog. Ooh, we delight in it. And that meant, you know, we get the cold hot dog at lunch. So that's what sometimes happens. So you've got to be very careful. Delight in it. Gives rise to discontent. If a bhikkhu should wish, bhikkhuni lama lowun, may I become a conqueror of danger and anxiety, sort of fear and dread. And may that fear and dread not conquer me. May I abide transcending fear and dread whenever they arise. Then let you fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, but recessive insight and dwell in seclusion. That's really true, because, you know, sometimes there are dangerous things. Remember my own preceptor. Now, he told me, because when I was years ago talking about meditation, you know, he even knows the acting Sangharaja now of Thailand. He used to meditate, and he said once he was meditating in the south of Thailand in some jungle, and when he came out of meditation, there was a venomous snake on his lap. And he said, no, he surprised himself that, you know, he was not at all afraid. He just, oh, a nice little snake, enjoying itself. And he was totally at peace with it. He said, that's the power of meditation. You just don't have fear. And it's, you know, living in the jungles, you know, where there's all these animals and snakes and stuff which can bite you and, you know, really cause a lot of problems to you. You do actually find that. And if you keep your precepts, there's something about the precepts you feel like protected. And if you have good meditation, you're not really afraid. So you can stay in those caves where there are ghosts. You can stay in the jungles. You're not at all afraid. It's weird, but no, that's actually what happens. So if any of you are just really anxious and afraid of the kangaroos, afraid of them, afraid of ghosts, it's, you know, just keep your precepts. There's something about the precepts you realise, no, I've done heaps and heaps of good karma, I'm pure, there's nothing can harm me. And, you know, do meditation, just, well, I've got nothing to lose, so nothing in here, so what the hell? So you don't have fear. So it's interesting, this is what happens, and it's one of the reasons why you can tell a person's meditation, especially insight, if they do suffer from fear. You know, and if somebody sort of, you know, if you're afraid of dying, or someone comes up with a knife, and you go, ah! Then you're obviously not enlightened yet. So if you want to overcome fear, this is what happens. If a monk should wish, now we get to the great stuff. May I become one? This is overcoming, it's interesting, overcoming fear and dread. The next thing, May I become one to obtain at will, without trouble or difficulty, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and provide a pleasant abiding here and now. May you fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight, and dwell in seclusion. So for those of you who want the jhanas, that's what you have to do, fulfill your precepts. Because sometimes people think, oh, you don't need to fulfill the precepts, crazy wisdom, do whatever you like, and just still get jhanas. Buddha's saying, no way. Or you can just, you know, do the jhanas sort of, you know, when you're at home, you know, when you come home from work. No, dwell in seclusion. Oh, you don't need insight to get jhanas. You need insight. Wisdom power. You get jhanas. And then, without trouble or difficulty. And that's what one has to do. So this is saying, okay, later on, you've got compassion for others, you want to get rid of fear and dread. It's interesting that fear and dread coming just before the jhanas. I don't know how many times I've told people in interviews, fear is one of the reasons you can't let go. The dread. Oh, my body's disappearing. My will is going. Ah! Sometimes the fear and dread is a precursor. You have to let go of the fear and dread in order to really let go. So fear and dread which stops you letting go is one of the reasons why it's put here just before the jhanas. Da da da. Questions?
Yes. Ever since my friend and me, we are chanting our jhana group, and we hit eight precepts, but we didn't ask formally from you.
Yeah.
And sometimes we you have very clear what kind of thing we can drink.
Yes. Well, remember, the eight precepts are not the property of myself or anybody, so I can't give them to you. I can give you a glass of water, because I've got water here, but the precepts are just things which you determine. You don't need to ask them from a monk. You just make a resolution, I'm going to keep those eight precepts. Sometimes people do it in front of a monk because that's just a nice formal ceremony to remind you, yes, I am going to keep these precepts. You do it in front of a Buddha statue or just in your heart say, I'm going to keep the precepts. That's good enough. The most important thing is not taking the precepts, but keeping them. Because many people take the precepts. Sometimes in some monasteries they take the five precepts every day. But they don't keep them. They keep them for about 5 minutes. So the most important thing is keeping them, not taking them. And as for what you can drink in the evening, it gets so complicated sometimes. I used to say that young monks, the part of the rules which they spend so much time studying is what goes into the mouth and when it goes in there. So just take it easy, just have some juice, apple juice. Over in Jhana Grove you're allowed to have milk but not over here. You can have cheese over there but not over this side. So it's just, it's complicated, but that's just the way we do it. But don't worry about it. So if you want more information, just ask somebody else. So they get tired of what goes in the mouth and why it goes in. Why you can have cheese but you can't have milk. Why over there but not over here. So, anyway. Okay. So may become one to obtain at will without trouble or difficulty. If a monk, nun, layman, or women should wish, now this is a great point. May our contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. Hang on. These are immaterial attainments, arupa, incorporeal. How can it say contact with the body? Can you contact with the body? The immaterial states? Exactly, because this is the idiom, contact with the body. Ajahn Brahmani has written a whole paper about this. The contact with the body. It's Kayapati Sangvedi. It's an idiom which means direct experience. So it literally means, my, I have personal experience. Even personal, there's no one in here, but that's the idiom.
Now, personal experience doesn't mean that, you know, I experience it, you know, myself. It just means that, you know, you're the one who has that experience, even though there's no one. That's where it gets very difficult. But so contact with a body here means, you know, direct experience. So it's not a theory anymore. You've been there. Okay, Maya can obtain a will. I think that with the rupas, the jhanas, they're making the point there that may be easy for you. You just let go and it happens. So in other words, sometimes people struggle and struggle and struggle. So this makes it easy. And it's nice, I didn't mention here, constitute the higher mind, the adi-citta, and provide a pleasant abiding here and now. So it's a pleasure. Pleasant abiding? Are we supposed to have pleasure? Pleasant abiding? That must be bad. You get attached to that. And of course, you're supposed to have that pleasant abiding. If a bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, layman should wish, may I, with the destruction of the three fetters, become a stream winner, no longer subject to perdition, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment. Let him fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight and dwell in seclusion. Now this actually comes after the jhanas. This is being a stream winner. So does this mean that you have to do the jhanas before you become a stream winner? I reckon so, because this is the usual list. Get the jhanas first, stream winner afterwards. Destruction of the three fetters. What are those three fetters? What is number two? Number two. I make it difficult for people. Yes, right, rites and rituals. What does that mean? Siddha Bhatta Paramasa. Paramasa means attachment. And Siddha. Very good, yeah. So it's not just rituals, it's much more than that. It says later on, if you want to get out of samsara, what do you have to do? Not rituals, you have to keep the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity. Well, that comes afterwards. So, what's the third precept? I'm supposed to have doubt. Are you going to be a know-it-all and just be so certain that, you know, you're right and everyone else is wrong? Isn't it good to have doubt? But you're supposed to overcome doubt to be a stream winner. So what's going on here? That mean you're just this big know-it-all, always right and you're never wrong? It's only doubt about certain things, obviously. You already mentioned doubt about the Buddha's enlightenment, doubt about the Dhamma. He can, because he's saying he's not a stream winner yet. He's being honest. So that's fine. So, because he trusts the Buddha's enlightenment. No, trust it, but doesn't believe it. It's just like Sariputta was asked by the Buddha, and the Buddha said, do you believe this? He said, no, I don't, because I haven't achieved it yet. So that's being very, very wise. That's the next Sariputta, mudito. What he's saying, I don't know yet, because I've not been enlightened myself. So how do I know the Buddha's enlightenment? Until I've had enlightenment myself, then I can know. Yes, the Buddha was enlightened.
In other words, it just becomes a religion.
Yeah, but you can trust it. You know, this just sounds good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, fair enough. You're both right. What doubt really obviously is doubt, you know, about the Buddha's enlightenment, doubt about sort of whether this is the right path or not. So otherwise it becomes true when you're like, okay, yeah, this is okay. You've had direct experience. You've touched it with a body. Yeah? Yeah, sounds good.
I think that was just sort of, what's the last thing you said about after the Buddha, about the
I don't know. You've got what did I say?
Something about direct experience?
Oh, yes, yes. So you've got this some direct experience. So it's about what enlightenment is. Some taste.
And just a question about the one before about the phrasing. I can't ask, but you didn't answer, so I thought I'll ask again.
Okay.
Arupa, it says, my contact with direct experience the Arupa. So I was just wondering why it didn't say direct experience the jhanas, but...
Yeah, I think it's maybe just focusing on something else.
Okay, so just because you can't say one thing.
Yeah. So, and of course, the first fetter is the personality view. And that is Sakaya Ditti. Even it says Kaya in there. I know there's some monks who think that first fetter is thinking your body is a self. Because it actually says Sakaya with a body. But, you know, what it really means, as you all know, it's defined many, many times. It's thinking that any of these five khandhas, the body, feeling, perception, mental formations, including your will, or your consciousness, all the six consciousnesses, including the mind, thinking any of these can be a self, or can be contained in the self, or the self is contained in them, or be somehow related to the self. And seeing there's no self in them at all. That is the overcoming of Sakaya Ditti. Yes, body of views, they have a body of views, they have a body of troops, they have a body is can be anything. Yes. It doesn't actually give you too much information, except in a couple of suttas. And one of them, it says to overcome it, you know, the two proximate causes is yonisamanasikara and paratagosa. And I always say that yonisamanasikara use its deep meaning of going to the source, work of the mind which goes to the origin of things. And of course, that idea of going to the origin, with that simile of the thousand petal lotus going in, it's going through the jhanas as well. And it goes right into the center of things, so you know there's nothing in this will. Or like the simile somebody was telling me the other day, the great simile in the Kanda Samyutta of the body being compared to foam on the river Ganges. So the foam, there's nothing in there, it's just little bubbles. Inside there's nothing in there, it's totally empty of any substance. Or the Vedana, you know, the pleasure and pain, be like a drop of rain in a puddle, plop! It's so quick and it disappears again. Or the perception, you know, being like the mirage, which is there's something there, but it's, you know, you're giving it a meaning it doesn't deserve. And the mental formations, including will, that being the plantain tree, the banana tree, was the simile they got. But you can't go past Venerable Gunaratna, who, instead of using a plantain tree, used something very similar but much better, the onion. Because if you peel an onion, you can peel, and there's nothing in the middle of it, just like the plantain tree. But the nice thing about an onion is it makes you cry, because that's what will does. You know, it just brings you to tears sometimes as you peel it. And also, as he said in English, the onion, it goes on and on with an eye in the middle. And that's very brilliant. That's Bhante Ji. That's the will. Yeah, go on. Correct, yeah. And lastly, the consciousness was a magician's trick, putting the rabbit out of the hat. making things appear. It's not true. So that's the, it's lovely, the Maya, the magician's trick. So that's what, you know, this consciousness is totally changing. But you really think it's something permanent. Anyway, that's actually seeing such things as seeing the emptiness of it all. I better carry on. Because that's actually the three life fetters and no longer subject to perdition. What does that mean? Perdition. It means you cannot get reborn again in the hell realms, in the ghost realms, or the animal realms. Even if you've done bad karma, you can't go down. Now, why not? It's really unfair. You know, you just got to get out of jail card for free. That's why, yeah, you've heard me talk this before. It's interesting. It never actually says why that's so. And I always wondered, why is it that because you come a stream winner, you can't get reborn in the bad realms because you've, you know, maybe been a bad person? Now, how come that karma doesn't work? And it's because a lot of time karma works because you think you deserve to be punished or you deserve to be rewarded. Sense of self is actually at the centre of much of the law of karma.
What about Richard's dream states? Is the Aryan free of them as well?
Pretty much, I reckon. Okay. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I, with the destruction of the three fetters, already done, and with the attenuation of lust, hatred and delusion, become a once returner, returning only once to this world to make an end of suffering, let them fulfil the precepts, and be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect jhanas, be possessed of insight and dwell in seclusion. So, if, say, Danny is a once returner, how many more times is he reborn? If he's a once returner.
If he already is a once returner?
He's a once returner. He gets once returned in this life.
Yeah.
So how many more lives has he got left?
Zero.
Trick question.
You've
got to go somewhere before you return from it. So you get two lives. So if he's a once returner now, when he dies, they say for the most part he goes to the Tushita realm and then comes back to this world. So the return to this world only once. But you usually go up to the Tushita realm, have a break, have a holiday, then come back and finish off. I love this trick question because it's like you have two more lives. Well, like the Buddha, yeah, because he came from the Tushita realms. So, you're a stream winner. How many more births does a stream winner have?
Six.
You're too good. Okay, because it's this life plus six more. Okay, next question. And next, not question, next thing. So that's interesting. How much do you have to attenuate lust, hate and delusion to become a once returner? No, 50%, 10%, 90%? They don't actually say it. That's why it's really difficult to know who was a once returner and who wasn't. Because there was in the, yeah, it was in the Sangyutra Nikaya, I think, there was Isidatta and Purana. And the Buddha said both of them were once returners. And people were really a bit surprised at that because one of them, you know, had a wife, was just you know, just an ordinary person. I said, how come he's a once returner? And you know, he said, and the other person just, you know, renounced everything. How come he's only once returner, not a non-returner? He said, one of them, yes, you know, he still had some sort of lust, but he was very, very wise. The other one had hardly any lust, but he wasn't as wise. So even then it was very difficult actually to say about how much you have to give up to be a once returner. That's very undefined. Yes?
You said when you become a stream winner, it's an event.
Yeah.
It's an event. And then when you become a sannyasi, and again you get to the events? Or?
Yeah, now that's a very good question. Stream winner is an event. That's why that... because there is a monastic rule It's Paticca 8, claiming a state of, say, of us being a stream winner or once returner. That's against the rules for a monk to tell people, except for other monks or nuns. You can tell other monks or nuns, you know what you've been doing, but you can't tell lay people. That's a Paticca. And if you lie about it, that's a Parajika. You have to leave the monkhood. So it's very serious. You're not supposed to tell people. So if somebody actually does make a claim, now part of the thing, the monks have to find, you know, is it sort of a full Parajika or is it a Paticca? You know, is it a real claim or not? So if they say they're a stream winner, in the Vinaya they give you what a monk should do to find out, in a question them. And one of the questions is, you have to ask a person, they claim to be a stream winner, when and where, what time? Because it's an event. With the once returner, it's not an event. This is my view of it, okay? So it doesn't actually say either way. Non-returner, yes, certainly an event. And obviously arahat, an event. Yeah.
So, are arahats exempt from that? Because I know that Ajahn Mahabodh wrote about becoming an arahat.
Yes, breaking the precepts. Clear. That's why a lot of people say, what do you do that for? That's, you can't break precepts. Very clear. Yep.
So Ajahn is once returner an event.
Yeah, no, I don't think it is. Because the, there's a simile in the Anguttara, which is also one which I mentioned in the book. It's about the seven shipwrecked sailors. And the last four, the fourth shipwrecked sailor is the one who is floating up because of his good seal. He can keep his head above water, literally. And he looks around, he can see dry land. So that's a stream winner. You can see Nibbana. You know what you're doing now. And the once returner is the one, once you've seen dry land, you're swimming towards it. Doesn't say actually how far you've swum or how much is to go. That's the once returner. You started swimming. And the non-returner is where you're so close to dry land, you don't need to swim anymore. You can just stand up. You're still in the water, but you're wading to the shore. And the arahat is the one who's got to the shore. I always say, sitting under the coconut tree, having a hot dog. Well, I added that one. Whatever else you like, you know. Yeah. Yes?
You know, like, with this delusion, I remember in last year's class, you mentioned that, so, the stream runner has right view, but arahat has destroyed delusion, and that's when there's no deluded thought or
that's right, yeah.
All that. So here, delusion is the same thing as, like, any...
you have moments when you forget.
Okay, so just attenuation
that's right, yeah.
And all that stuff.
Correct. If a bhikkhu should wish, or bhikkhuni, layman, laywoman, may I, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, become due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world, let him fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect jhanas, be possessed of insight, and dwell in empty places. So this is the non-returner, this is the anagami. The five lower fetters are, again, the personality view, the attachment to rites and rituals, the doubt, plus the greed and ill will. Or like lust, sensory desire. Kama, chanda, vayapada. Or kama raga. So it's the delight in the five senses and all the happiness and joy of the five senses. And the consequent ill will which comes along with that. So basically you've let go of the body and the delights in the things of the world. So that's the anagami. And then you reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes. That means as soon as you die from this realm, you're not a baby. So when you get reborn in the pure abodes, you don't have to have a mother who feeds you. You're already mature in the pure abodes. So, you know, you don't have to go to school in a pure abode because you're already mature, you know. Just, you don't have to grow up, you're already just fully there. So you reappear spontaneously, fully formed. You don't have to go through the maturity process. Yeah?
Should we reborn in the deva of Rama if he's the same?
Yeah. Or is there baby devas? That's right. It's only in the animal realm and the human realm if you have to be born as babies and get mature up. So, okay. And if a monk should wish, may with the destruction of spontaneously impure abodes and obtain final nibbanas. Now, if a monk should wish, may I wield the various kinds of supernormal power. Having been one, may I become many. Having been many, may I become one. May I appear and vanish. May I go unhindered through a wall, through an enclosure, through a mountain as through space. May I dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. May I walk on water without sinking as though it were the earth. Seated cross-legged, may I travel in space like a bird. With my hand may I touch and stroke the moon and sun so powerful and mighty. May I wield bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma world. Anyone want to do that? Would that be cool? Awesome to do? It mean you wouldn't have to sort of get on an aircraft to go back to the United States. You just disappear from here and just get there straight away. No customs, no waiting in the airports. Brilliant. So if you do, what should you do? Fulfill the precepts, the virtues and terms of the way, not neglect jhanas, recessive insight, and live in seclusion. Psychic powers. Yes?
You know, like the things might be not meditation and
recessive
insight. What does that mean,
recessive
insight? Is that the three?
No, just vipassana, which means any, you know, all sorts of insights. So it's not specific. General insight into all sorts of things.
So anything not
the three characteristics? Three characters especially, that's the main insight. It's also the three vijas, So it's just the general insight.
So cause and effect?
Cause and effect is part of it, dependent origination is part of it.
Okay.
The general meaning of insight, not specific. That's right.
What does it mean?
That's interesting. Just like you know how to stroke the cat? That's easy to do, but be able to put your hand up and stroke the moon and the sun without getting burnt. It could be, but I don't know, basically, because it's really weird. Because obviously there's some great power. Why you want to do that anyway? You can see the point of like diving through the earth, that might be cool. Maybe go to the moon. But you know, the sun, I don't know about that. Anyway, I don't know basically. It's weird. If a monk, nun, lama, lay women should wish, may with the divine ear element, which is purified and surpasses the human, hear both kinds of sound, the divine and the human. Those that are far as well as near, then let you fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect jhanas, be possessed of insight, and dwell in empty abidings. So this is being able to. And I remember that, I think I told many people the story, that when I first went to Wat Pa Phong, there was one monk who possessed that, who actually managed to do that. And he could actually hear these what people were saying in the market, which was about 8-10 kilometres away from the monastery. And it was real. So people got very excited about him. But that particular monk, because you know, he developed a psychic power, you know, he really thought that he was enlightened. Because if you get psychic powers, he obviously had great meditation. And one day he sat in Ajahn Chah's chair and started teaching people. And then Ajahn Chah sort of blasted him for that. And he realised that he just, you know, the pride part of the psychic powers had taken over. He realised it wasn't enlightened, and the next day he bowed to all the monks in the monastery, then disappeared and never saw him again. Probably just carried on his practice in some remote place. But you know, he was humble enough. He really understood that he'd got great meditation, but had got the danger of conceit. Look what I can do, just like Devadatta. But you know, it showed it can be done.
And what is the protection against that kind of mistake?
You got very good precepts, yes, be devoted to internal serenity of mind.
How do you protect against that kind of mistake? How do you see the downfall there?
Well, the best thing is having a good teacher. So the teacher can actually see the signs and just stop you before you go too far. And it's also having enough understanding of the Dhamma. So some of those monks had great meditation, but they didn't have much exposure to the formal teachings. So they were getting there, but they were didn't have the map, so they sometimes got lost.
So, I mean, does that arise when you think that the power is a possession?
Exactly, yeah, you think it's coming from me. Yeah. So look how great I am, I've got all these powers, rather than realising it's a result of letting go. Okay, is that a question? If a monk should wish, may I understand the minds of other beings, of other persons, having encompassed them with my own mind? In other words, may I read people's minds? Understand the thing. May I understand the mind affected by lust as affected by lust, the mind unaffected by lust as unaffected by lust? Understand the mind affected by hate, my unaffected by hate? A mind affected by delusion, not by delusion, a contracted mind, distracted mind, exalted mind, unexalted mind, surpassed, unsurpassed, concentrated mind, concentrated mind, unconcentrated as concentrated, liberated one as liberated, and unliberated as unliberated. Where does that come from? That's right, that's the Chittanupassana. And for me this is a little bit the confusing things I hear a bit, because that's the Chittanupassana. If you look at the Chittanupassana, this is to know a mind affected by lust as affected by lust, not affected as unaffected. So it seems to be a bit of crossover here. Because really, all one needs to say is, may I understand the minds of other beings, of other persons, having encompassed them with my own mind. So it doesn't really belong here as far as I'm concerned, but it's standard in all of the definitions of mind reading.
This one sounds disgusting, actually.
Yeah.
If I had that, it would be terrible.
But anyway, if you don't want it, then don't keep your precepts. if you want that sort of stuff, remember what he's actually saying is, you know, some people actually want to do these things because they think it's cool. Oh yeah, sure, people would like to do that. They want to have powers, because a lot of times it's their ego. But they say, okay, just like Nanda, if you want those things, do these things. Obviously, that, you know, you may get them, but you actually go all the way to enlightenment, so it doesn't really matter so much.
But the other one's pretty good. You know, cool, you can go through the earth and fly around and do all that. But this one, you have to know it's going, all the shit going to other people's
mind. Ah! But to be able to fly around the earth or whatever, go through the, it's only if you want to. So you don't have to fly if you don't want to. You have to determine to fly. The same way reading people's minds. It's not like you've got sort of openness that, you know, everything which is a many mind passing by, you hear it. It's only if you want to.
You have to make a determination.
You have to incline your mind to it. Yeah. So a lot of people who develop that, after a while they stop inclining their minds to it.
Mm-hmm.
They think it's, because one of the reasons is because it's, you know, it's what most people say, it's an invasion of privacy. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, and if people know you can read their minds, they become very afraid in your presence. You know, because they won't even come see you. You know, because they think, oh my God, you know, you can read my mind. That'd be terrible. Especially if he tells other people, you know, what Yasan is thinking or what she thought today. Bad!
Is that an outflowing?
An outflowing? It's interesting, because it is an outflowing of the mind, yeah.
That's not really good.
But sometimes it just happens naturally. When you meditate a lot, there's just things happen. So it first happens naturally. Usually afterwards, the people control it and just give it up. It's not sort of a nice thing to do. Yeah?
I did have a question about the previous 150.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Does that relate also to people having conversations with David?
That's interesting, yeah, having conversations with David. Of course, you've got to be very careful here that this is not going into schizophrenia. No, that's a true one, because there's many people who think they have conversations with devas and other beings, it's just schizophrenia, it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be careful on this one. So many mystics in the past and the saints
A lot of times people say they were probably just suffering from schizophrenia. There wasn't sort of some contact with God. They were just mad. So the real ones, yeah, sometimes you can have conversations with these beings, but again, just like reading people's minds, why would you want to do that anyway? Because people have the idea that these divine beings are wise. But there's the great Sakapanha Sutra in the Digha Nikaya. And the Buddha was in the, what the cave was called outside of Rajagopa? It was Indasala, Inda something cave. But anyway, that he was meditating there, and one of the gods came to see him to ask questions. And you know, the Buddha sort of recognized that this was one of the gods and said, "Hello, what questions do you want to ask?" And at that, this god was just bowed down and said, at last I managed to ask my questions. Because I've been to see all these other sages who develop this power, and as soon as I appear, they ask me the questions. Because they think, my goodness, I've seen God, I've seen a divine being, and I can never ask my questions because they want to ask me theirs. And at last, as somebody who realises I'm just a stupid deva, and you know, I can ask my questions. And it's really interesting, because if a deva appeared to you right now, you know, Matt, to ask you questions, you know, what would you do? My God, I've seen a deva. This is so cool. Can you please, you know, tell me this, tell me that. What's it like in deva realm? You know, just, what do you do all day? But, you know, they want to ask you the questions. That's why it's amazing. So anyway, just listen to devas. Too many questions. Okay, and then, number 17. If a monk, nun, layman, laywoman should wish, may I recollect my manifold past lives? And they always say one, two, after many births, with their aspects and particulars. So if you want to remember past lives and find out at last whether there is such a thing as rebirth or not, whether this is just something which was added by the Buddha, or whether it was really true or not, then what you need to do is fulfill your precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect jhanas, be possessed of insight, dwell in seclusion, and then you can do that. Can be done. Yes.
I'm just wondering, before, you know how the Eightfold Path starts with right view, but this practice, he's only emphasizing, you know, the virtue, like the restraint, the training. It doesn't start with right view, yet you get all these consequences of free will and all that. So how do
we do it? Because it's focusing on sila, samadhi, panya. Insight, yes. Be possessed of insight. Sila, samadhi, panya. So the first one is the sila. You know, may you be keep your precepts. Samadhi, not neglect seclusion. Be devoted to be devoted to internal serenity of mind and not neglect jhanas. That's the samadhi, and be possessed of insight is a panya.
But the panya that comes, don't you have to know the teaching?
Oh yes, but that's the insight. But okay, I see what you mean there. The exposure to the Dhamma, yeah. But that's, I think that's probably assumed, because these are people who are listening to the Dhamma already.
Right.
Would that be then, using your analogy, would the lighting of secluded places be sunyata?
Yes, yeah. Empty places, not just physical places,
mm-hmm.
but sort of mental emptiness as well.
The Chinese, I think, take that as one of the goals, rather than the bond.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, the goal and the journey coinciding. And if a monk, nun, layman, laywoman should wish, may I, with the divine eye which is purified and surpassed, we've already got the divine eye, this is the divine eye, see beings pass away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and fortunate, may I understand how beings pass on according to that karma. Bhikkhu Bodhi, instead of actions, the word is karma, so just leave it karma, because that's such a common English word. So understand how karma works, why people get reborn this way, why get reborn that way. Then if you understand the law of karma, then let you fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect jhanas, be possessed of insight, and dwell or resort to secluded or empty abodes. So those last two are the two vijas, and the third vija is coming next, the end of it all.
If a monk should wish, a nun should wish, a layman, a laywoman should wish, may I, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, here and now, enter upon and abide in deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the outflowings. May you fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect jhanas, be possessed of insight and dwell in empty places. So if you want the whole goal, the full enlightenment. So it was with reference to this that it was said, you know, the precepts. Bhikkhus, dwell possessed of virtue, possessed of the Patimokkha, restrained with the restraint of the Patimokkha, perfect in conduct and resource, seeing danger in the slightest fault, trained by undertaking the training precepts, because that's the start of all this. Let you fulfill the precepts. Yes?
Okay. So here, you know, when we talked about the arupas, it said we translated by contact with the body, and then you said it translated as directly experienced.
Yes, yeah.
But here we actually have directly experienced it, or
yeah.
By realizing for myself as direct knowledge. So what's the difference between direct knowledge?
Okay, I think that is the that's right, yeah, that's abhinya. It's, they have these different words, panya, abhinya, parinya, it all comes to this nya, it's this knowing. And abhinya means almost like deep understanding, like abhidharma, like abhivinya, abhinya. And he just pronounced that as direct knowledge, direct knowing. But it's just deep knowing, it's profound knowing. We've got so many different words for wisdom in Pali, and we've only got one or two in English. So it's nothing, it's no connection with direct knowledge and experiencing with the body. There's no connection between those two.
Could you give us literally how it knowledge?
No, it's just, it's abhinya, I mean really total, powerful, very deep sort of understanding. Because that's what the word abhi means. You know, you've got abhidharma, you've got abhivinya, which is, you know, the restraints of the senses. They've got abhijnana, which is, you know, this one, abhinya, means, you know, really deep understanding. Yeah.
Go back a little. The two understandings, the one about rebirth and the one about karma.
Yeah.
The one about rebirth, very specific actually, things for understanding according to the sutta, a very specific yourself, you know your name, knowing what clan you belong to, the things you enjoy eating,
yeah.
How long you live, all this stuff. Do you know anyone who's actually experienced that?
Yeah.
I mean, in our time.
Well, I understand their past lives, sure. Many people have.
To that detail.
Yeah, because what happens is, as soon as you get into those states, then you can actually ask those questions. As soon as you incline your mind to that question, what's my name, then it comes up. You know, what you ate, whatever. Yes, many people do that.
You're talking about all these things that someone can do.
Yeah.
The Buddha saying that, you know, it's like a sidetrack, you know, more important to focus on the.
That's right, yeah.
On these things. The last two seem to be more important. I thought those were things that you needed to do and you have to do to get enlightened.
Well, that should, yes.
Good. So
yes, good. Because elsewhere it says that those are the three, the first of the first two crackings of the egg before the chick hatches. He gives a simile. So, you know, when a chick is being hatched, the first crack in the egg, that's actually seeing your previous lives. The second crack in the egg is when you understand karma. And with those two cracks, then you can jump out of the egg, and that's when you're fully enlightened.
Those have to come in that order, or can they be skipped?
They can be skipped, apparently, because not all people remember their past lives who have become enlightened. So it seems it can be skipped. But it's certainly, it's very helpful.
Okay, so these are things that may or may not happen.
Indeed, yeah. Yes.
In the time of Buddha, when there were like Aryans and also lay people on the path to Sringmani, I guess they didn't have the Pachamanka being lay people. But so what were they doing in their conduct? Were they measuring it against the Eightfold Path?
Yeah, measuring about Eightfold Path, measuring against like the ten Akusala and Kusala Dhammapadas. That which was a very common thing for lay people to do, which is, you know, the basically the five precepts expanded with right view, right speech. Sorry, so it's not just lying, but not sort of having malicious speech, gossip, that sort of stuff. So that may have been what they were doing. Their precepts, sense restraint.
But did you say the ten akusala?
Akusala kamapata. Oh. That's word of the Buddha beginning. Remember. Have a look at it next time. Yes.
You know the last one, number 19. Just two things. The first one is here. Enter upon and abide.
Oh yeah.
The limits of mind, and also the second is taintless and the destruction of the taint. So we had before the sutra on blemishes, and but taint here is that the outcome.
Outcome, yes, the outcome, yeah. Without asavas.
So taintless is without asava.
And asava.
And then the destruction of the asavas.
Yeah.
And what about, and here enter.
Point of pride. That means, what that means is once you have that experience, it stays with you. Okay. So it's like you enter upon and abide in the first jhana. But here, but it's once you have the deliverance, become an arahat, that's forever. Until. Is it forever? Can you stop being an arahat? Yeah. When you prepare nirvana, then you're no longer an arahat, nothing.
But you know, like, basic in conduct and resort, like in the old days when there were like arahants who were ordained and on the path, does perfect in conduct and resort, is that seems to be different for unordained people?
It is, yes, but I mean, there's many dangerous places you can go as an unordained person. It's still, you know, if you sort of go to a brothel or something and people sort of see you, they think, gee, Mark, what are you doing that for? Mm. It's the wrong thing for you to go.
But, you know,
I don't know. Maybe things have changed, I don't know, since I was young.
I think so. But, like, you know, even for example, like in the lay life, there's people go to food halls and do all sorts of things,
yeah.
You know, whereas a monk may not sort of go at certain times with people to do. It seems as though that in the station of life as lay people, that there's a different standard there.
There's a different standard, yeah. There's places you can go which are fine, which if I went there, people might criticise me.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, in the old days, there were lay people who were very highly attained in the old way. And how is it that they could attain that and yet not have the full restraint of the Padamaka?
Oh, it's just because they still had enough precepts, enough wisdom. The Pachamanka becomes a much more sure vehicle. So just like this morning when we went to Janagosi, all these people were actually, the bike people had just climbed up the hill and were just resting outside the monastery. So yeah, you can get up the hill on a bicycle, but personally I wouldn't suggest it. A car is much, much better. They were puffing and sweating on all of them. So yeah, you know, a lay person, yeah, you can do these things. But you know, it's puffing, a lot of puffing and sweating, as you know. Yeah. That's why we've got the Sangha. It's a nice vehicle.
I've heard it said that a woman who is a samanera cannot attain a certain stage because she doesn't have the full ordination.
That's rubbish. Even novices in the time of the Buddha were fully enlightened with psychic powers.
But don't they really say that in Burma? Because Sayali Dipankara, I think I heard it from her.
No.
Even so that they have to become a bhikkhuni in order to...
No. Samanera is fine.
Really?
Yeah.
But don't the Burmese fully believe that, don't they?
No, it's true to say opposite.
Oh.
This is the famous novice, Sumana,
I think, who was it? I think Sariputta was sick or something, and the Buddha suggested what he needed was some water from this mythical lake in the Himalayas. So, but the trouble was, there was a big Naga dragon living there. So the Buddha sent this little novice Sumana to catch the water. He was only about 7 or 8 years of age. And of course, as soon as he went to get the water flying through the air to this lake, the dragon didn't like that at all. Because, you know, maybe if it was a big monk, the dragon would have let him take some water, but not this whippersnapper, you know, novice. So they had this big battle, you know, with the novice. And finally, the novice got on top of the dragon's head and pushed him under the water. And the dragon just gave up, okay, you're much more powerful than I am, you can take some water. And so he brought it back and, you know, it's, I think, cured Sariputta's sickness. This is in the Theravada commentaries. And then the next day, the novice was on arms round, and all his monks were sort of teasing him, tweaking his ears, knocking him on the head, just teasing him, come on, you know, do this, do that. And when the Buddha saw how they were treating this novice, he called all the monks together and said, you don't know whose head you were knocking. That little novice is fully enlightened with all the psychic powers, and yesterday he defeated the Naga in this big lake to bring back this water. So be careful. It could be a little novice monk, it could be a novice nun. You don't know who you're talking with. So that's where he sort of said the four small things never to be, didn't know, to be looked after, to be wary of. You know, the small fire, because it can be turned into a bushfire, a small snake, because even if it's a baby snake, they still have venom, and a small prince, because, you know, they may end up becoming the emperor, and they remember what you did to them. And lastly, a small novice. So, you're the smallest of the novices. So be careful, you don't know. So don't knock him on the head or tweak his ears.
Yeah, Ajahn has the same type of question. Is it true that if a lay person becomes an arahant,
yes,
to ordain?
Yeah, you've got two choices. You don't have to ordain.
Otherwise he would die.
Yes, well, that's the second choice.
That's what they say about nuns, no, that
aren't
bhikkhunis. So are
bhikkhunis? No, but some and others are okay. Novices are okay. But lay people, so either become a monk or no more messing around. And actually, that's what it says. And
what do you mean?
And I reckon that's absolutely true. Simply because, you know, if you become an arahant, this, you know, your will has totally been abandoned. There's nothing to keep you alive anymore. The will to live is one of the four nutriments, and without that, you pass away. So the only reason to live, if you're an arahant, is to be a field of merit to others and to teach. You become a monk, it's the only thing, or a nun. Novice is enough. You have to join the Sangha. Otherwise, there's nothing to keep you here. You just vanish. Remember that point, you're not afraid of dying, you get out of samsara as quick as possible, unless there's some reason to stay behind. And that's either to teach or to be a field of merit for other people.
You do that through meditation?
What?
To leave this
realm? No, not through meditation, you stop. So it is meditation, but totally, you know, automatically, not willed. When you remember there's no will, you let go. You stop. Everything stops and just finishes.
So dare I raise the question about the Bodhisattva there?
Close that. No, don't weigh that.
I will.
You didn't make it anyway. No one makes it. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any comments about the mark that Mahabhula made in his biography of Ajahn Mun?
Yes. No, because
all the powers.
Yeah, no, I've commented on that before, you know my sort of answer to that one. It's what we call like a nimitta. So just a way of experiencing something, but not to be taken as reality. Okay, otherwise we'll be here all night.
Now let's express our approval of this summer.
Very good.